Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to Phil Colicchio, coming to you live with the Business of the Business, the show that sheds light on the business and business of the restaurant and hospitality industries. We're airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. And if you missed this broadcast, you can always find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org, as well as on podcast iTunes. My guest today is a very special gentleman. My friend and colleague, the Riesling swilling, hard living Paul Greco. Good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
Good afternoon, Phil. Awesome, as a matter of fact.
Well, it's great to hear. And welcome to Roberta's. Welcome to Bushwick. I'm glad you could take the afternoon.
Can I express my embarrassment at this point and say it's my first time to Bushwick? It's scary out here.
There's a first time for everything,
yes,
Paul.
There is.
And you've had a number of firsts in your life, and I'm sure we're going to talk about a few of them. But first, let me tell the audience a little bit about you. I'm sitting here with the 2012 James Beard Foundation Award winner for Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. You might think that is the only time my friend Paul Greco would have gone up to the stage and accepted an award, but he didn't. He also did that in 2001 when he was a member of the Gramercy Tavern management team. He helped them achieve an award for outstanding service in 2001, and in 2002, outstanding wine service. So, Paul, between 2002 and 2012, what the hell were you doing?
I was existing in a dark room listening to a lot of Nine Inch Nails records. After I finished that, it hit me one day back in 2002 that if I was ever going to go out on my own and do something that I'd done my entire life, this is the only thing I've ever done. I was born into a restaurant in 1965, one that my grandfather and my father operated. I've known no other business, no other life. I may have railed against it a little bit here and there, but I was pulled back in every single time. And at that point in 2002, I said, if ever it's going to happen, this has to be it. And I resigned my position at Gramercy Tavern. I didn't have a safety net. I didn't have a place to go to, even though I knew I was going to open my own gig. And I left on Tuesday, October 1st, and on Wednesday, October 2nd, it was time to start pursuing my own gig, which eventually opened in November of 2003 and is known as Hearth.
And, you know, I want to say that you've given New York City, in particularly, an incredible gift with the businesses that you've helped to create during that time. And a couple of those businesses I certainly want to talk about, but you're one of the owners and founders of Hearth Restaurant, one of the city's great restaurants with an extraordinary wine program. You and your partner, the terrific and talented and visionary chef Marco Canora, also brought both of your passions to life again with the terroir restaurants and wine bars that certainly we want to talk about. But you also took another turn, a business turn, to take that passion you have for a grape from that most of us believe originated in Germany, the Riesling movement, and you are the genesis, the founder, the originator of the Summer of Riesling. Can you tell us about that? Tell us about how that became a not only a passion for you, but you turned that passion actually into a business. Can you tell us about that?
Certainly. in terms of my relationship with the grape, some think there's always an aha moment for a person who's in love with something. At this exact moment in time, you tasted X, and from that point on, your life changed. That's not the case. I had been drinking Riesling for a lot of years, and like a lot of different grapes and wines, it was part of my education. I certainly enjoyed it. I've always relished and reveled in those wines in areas that were off the beaten path, that were not easily accepted or liked by many people. And Riesling as a grape and as a wine is certainly that. And when I do a Riesling tasting, I always begin with a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, which is always off, you know, unsettling to people, but it's along the lines of convictions are greater enemies of truth than lies. And the conviction of Riesling is that it is always sweet. The truth, of course, is the exact opposite. And like most Psalms and wine people out there, we all love the Riesling grape. We are acid hounds. We love to finish our shift and have either a super cold beer, a lager, or a glass of Riesling, or a glass of sparkling wine, because it cleans your palate, and you want to drink more, and you're ready to go out and eat a little bit more. And in 2008, when we opened up the first terroir in the East Village, 550 square feet, all in, including a handicapped bathroom, 24 seats. I had no great desire to open a wine bar. The owner of the building came into Hearth, which is 80 feet away, and said, "Hey, guys, I got this space." We said, "Okay, cool, interesting."
An old bicycle shop, right?
An old bicycle shop. Yeah. We were doing another project at the time called Insieme, which was taking all of our time and energy and effort and things like that.
Yeah, we
was
want to talk about the lessons learned from that venture. But back to Riesling and terroir. A lot of people love Riesling. You've made it a common summer thought over the last 5 years. But you did that, and you actually then really became a promoter of the grape and of the regions, haven't you?
Well, listen, it all emanated from the first terroir. I viewed it, rightly or wrongly, as a sandbox. And that my occupancy costs were low. I only had 3 employees there, so my labor cost was low. So from a business standpoint, I knew if I was going to do something there, whatever it was, that I would not cause it to close. I could take risks.
Yeah.
And I was thinking one day, well, now this is my opportunity to do this with Riesling. So we opened in March of 2008, and as I was approaching June, I said, "This is it, man. Summer of Riesling. This summer, I'm only going to pour Riesling." There was no greater thought process than that. It was just one day, bingo. And so starting on the first day of summer, June 21st that year, I said, "That's it. No more multitude of grapes by the glass. All Riesling. Here we go." Staff hated it. Guests hated it. My partner, Mark, was like, "You've got to be out of your mind. You really have to be. Do you have to paint with such a broad brush? Can't you do like 15 Rieslings and a few Chardonnay?
Or Tuesday of Riesling."
Yeah, like,
I
was like, no, there are no half measures. And so we did it. And I can't say it was a great success, but we didn't lose money. As we approached 2009 summer, my staff said to me, "You're not going to do that summer Riesling thing again, are you?" And I'm like, "Oh, that's all I need, baby. Yes, we are." And that, it's no more complicated than that. It began from that. It was just me in my little sandbox of a wine bar taking the opportunity that, and listen, I recognize that my mates out there cannot take that risk, because invariably someone else is writing the checks for their beverage purchases. I sign the checks for my beverage purchases. And so I can make that big sweeping gesture. And I also had the nutsack, let's call it, to say, if my investors called and said, "Paul, we think this is a stupid business decision," I would have said, in all honesty, no. You know, we're paying $2,500 a month rent. We're not risking anything here.
Right. And it's interesting the way you phrase it, because you're using risk, using the phrase risk, and you're using what I perceive as a contrarian attitude, really perhaps an unconscious business model.
Listen, when we sit back and one day write the history of the restaurant world in, I don't know, New York City, America over the past 50 years, there's certainly going to be a chapter in there about David Chang, and I don't need to talk about the food or any of that, but what David brought to the conversation, and there could have been others too, but David, you know, Momofuku was, you know, a block and a half away from us.
Right.
He had a contrarian attitude towards everything that he was doing. Simply on the menu, if you wanted, you know, he had one vegetarian dish in this goddamn noodle shop, and that was like, people were apoplectic about that, but he said, "Listen, it's my way or the highway." And this was, for me and others who come from the Danny Meyer School of Hospitality, it's like, now it's in fashion to say no to people? And I will honestly say that David... infused, at least in me, this willingness to say no now and then, that this is my vision. And if you like my vision, you're going to stay here and have a great time. And you know what? If you don't like my vision, then there are other places for you to go. But as I will tell my investors and my partner, this contrarian view is not hospitable on the surface.
It's very Steve Jobs-like, Paul.
Well, in reading his biography, like, I would love to list 10 business books that inspired me and helped me in my career. I don't have any. But I'll tell you that Jobs biography, as I was sitting there reading it, I must have had a smile on my face for at least the majority of that read, because I'm like, oh my God, he's saying the same shit that I say, but in obviously a more intelligent way. But he never chased his consumer. He let his consumer come to him. And in a way, I did the same thing with Summer of Riesling and with the terroirs.
Well, that's very interesting that you had that reaction. I had a similar reaction when I read the book. I will tell you there were three or four times when I did think of you when I read the book, because there was a contrarian nature, but there was also a real conviction, a true FU conviction, that if you don't agree with me, I know that you know where the door is, but I'm going to take this shot because this is my opportunity. Now, I'm curious whether or not that came from something within you. You talked about earlier being born into a restaurant family and your family having started a restaurant in the 60s in Toronto and actually moving to the States. You know, I know also that you were an exceptionally talented soccer player at Sea Pines High in South Carolina. You don't talk much about that period. But I want to learn about it. But were your family risk takers? Did they do that when they started their restaurant businesses?
You know, I've never thought about this specific thing, but my grandpa, John Greco, started La Scala Restaurant, a very formal Italian restaurant in Toronto in 1961. He was 50 years of age. He had sold liquor for the previous 25 years. And at 50 years of age in 1961, to change careers as he did so completely must have been an unbelievable risk. My father joined him on the first day, and I was literally born there in 1965. And all of my memories are of going there on the weekends and helping my grandfather, my grandmother, my mom, my dad, all of that stuff. So I've never thought of my grandfather infusing me with this risk-taking thing. I just always remember being, you know, that little kid who always was like, but why? Okay, Daddy, but why? Always asking why. And that developed into a contrarian nature in my high school years and in my university years. And I love it. I don't like the road taken always. I prefer to take my own path. And in our industry, it's hard as hell to do, be it with wine, food, whatever, right, because we want to make people happy. We want to give people what they want. And from a business perspective, I want to be successful. The risks that we take are great because it does take a lot of money and time and manpower to put food and drink and things on the table for people.
And thought. Frankly, you put a lot of thought on the table for people in what you do and in how you provide it. Both you and your partner, Marco, I'm curious. We've known each other quite a while, and we've talked about it. But much is made whenever you talk about your history of a first big trip to Italy, where you became really one with the grape, and that became a real turning point and a seminal moment for you. Was there any sense when you were in Italy and evaluating that, was it all an experience that was visceral, or was there a component that said, hey, I like the way these people live, I like the way these people do their business, I want to be part of that?
It was the entirety of those 28 days in Italy. I had been asked to leave the University of Toronto because for 4 years I barely attended classes. I like to say that I practice my hospitality. But yes, I was asked to leave university, and my father grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and said, okay, now you're definitely working in the restaurant. And I did for June, July, and August. And halfway through August, he said, okay, Paul, come September 1st, you're going to Italy for 28 days by yourself. You're going to go to Tuscany for 2 weeks, Veneto for a week, Piedmont for a week. You're going to visit these producers, and you go into these restaurants. And I was like, no freaking way.
Did he give you a budget?
Let's not go there yet. I think I bankrupted the family on that trip. But I was like, no, this is not my life. Mm-hmm. But I went. And I went there in ignoramus. And I came back a relative genius, at least compared to the staff in my family's restaurant. But most importantly, what happened to me, as you alluded to, is that I became inspired. I found that in this world of wine and food and hospitality, all of these things that I was interested in, history, culture, civilization, religion, you know, little bits of, you know, geology, geography, wine, food, that I could not get a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Toronto because they wanted me to state my goddamn major, and I did not want to focus like that. I wanted to be the Renaissance man. I realized that in the world of wine and food, that you could be the Renaissance man. And as Danny Meyer, he gave me two pieces of advice when I left Gramercy Tavern, one of which is that, you know, when you build your place, make it complete. And that in that completeness, you get to exercise all of these different things that no other industry allows you to do. Right. I get to be a curator of music in my restaurant. I get to be a designer, an architect, a cook, a wine guy. Everything that we select in our joints, it infuses someone's experience that no other business out there can do. And that's a pretty damn awesome thing.
And this is, you're listening to The Business of the Business on heritageradionetwork.org. We're going to take a short break, Paul. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how that inspiration brought you to a couple of other points in your career that are just as fascinating as your history. Thanks. We'll be right back.
Is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Welcome back to The Business of the Business. I'm Phil Colicchio, broadcasting live here on the heritageradionetwork.org in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's. Looking out the studio window, watching people enjoy their...
Did you see that pizza out there? God
yeah,
damn it, that pizza looks good.
I have to say, it does look pretty good. I'm going to have to stop looking at it, Paul, or we're not going to get finished. Well, maybe we shouldn't finish. I'm having a great time talking with you. Paul, you began to talk about inspiration and inspiration with Danny, and we talked a little bit about the opening of Hearth. We talked about the first terroir in the East Village, the greatest name in the history, frankly, of restaurant wine bar, the Terroir Evil. We all love it. We love to say it. We love to hear it. But you took another chance after the opening of Terroir Evil, and from a business perspective, what went through your mind about, hey, I can replicate this and I've got some investors who might be interested in replicating this. Tell me how your mind worked when you saw a success with Terroir Evil.
Well, Marco and I have a penchant, as you address the name, of choosing names that are not easily pronounceable. When we opened Hearth, for the first 6 months, everyone was pronouncing it Hearth. And when Terroir was chosen, it's such a perfect wine term, and every wine person knows it, but the so-called man on the street became Terrier. No one could pronounce it. It was like, oh, geez. But anyway, we stuck with it. And another thing that Danny taught me, obviously a great teacher, is that well, this completeness that you approach a restaurant with, you begin with this kernel of an idea, and everything that you do within the space is tied back to that one thing. So terroir is not just viewed as a wine term that I need to choose wines that are reflective of specific terroirs. I felt, okay, so here we are in the East Village. It needs to encapsulate the terroir of the East Village.
Yeah.
How we act, the way it looks, all of these things need to speak East Village. And so we're up there, we're doing the wine bar, it's all cool. And then we began to think, and people began to say to us, well, why don't you do one of these in another neighborhood? I'm like, okay, cool. I never thought of, you know, more than one, but why can't every neighborhood have its own terroir? Because there is a terroir expression in each neighborhood, so let's just go there. So Tribeca was next. It opened up in 2010, a much larger space, and I got to confess, I was scared. East Village, 24 seats. Tribeca's 75 seats, three times the size. I never envisioned terroir that big. To me, it was unwieldy, and we got in there, and holy Lord, it took off, and I was like, my God, maybe 75 seats is the perfect size. And I began to make, Marco and I began to see, you know, nice cash flow, you know, the cost came into line, everything was good, and I could express my wine freedom, so to speak. And Marco came up with an unbelievable
menu.
Tasty, that can be replicated from a business standpoint, that Marco does not need to be there to oversee the production of food, which is important for a chef. It can't be everywhere. And it just went from there. And as we began to think more and more, it's like, well, again, why doesn't every neighborhood deserve its own terroir? The list could be somewhat similar. The food menu could be the same, but the space would feel different, expressing the terroir of a hood. Why not?
And, you know, Paul, that's very Paul Greco, very focused on a vision. And fortunately, you've got a partner who shares that vision with you 99% of the time. Occasionally, you've got to talk him into some things, and occasionally, he needs to talk to you. I'm curious, a person with a passion like you have and who expresses it with such conviction, you certainly can't do this alone. You have to bring investors along. How do you take that sort of unique passion that you have, which can be very focused, and express it to a group? And in your case, you're very populist as it relates to investors. You like to have lots of people involved.
Listen, we're about to open our fifth terroir.
Let's talk about that.
I have over 40 investors. Now, on one hand, I'm like, that's cool, more people out there who are fully invested in what we do, but I'll tell you, it is somewhat unwieldy. It's a lot of people to try and make happy, and I'm not so sure I do it well all the time, but it's a goal. Listen, Marco and I want to be looked upon as not just great cooks or great wine people or great servers or great hospitality people, but great business people. And I would confess we're still very much on that road. We have not achieved that yet. But ultimately, what the investor in a restaurant wants to do, yes, they're investing in a business. Yes, there is an expectation of a return. But ultimately, and this is almost to an individual what all 40 have verbalized to me, is that they are investing in me and Marco. It's us.
Yeah.
And maybe that passion that we have and the way we're able to put it across pulls them in, and someone says, how can I not want to be part of this? Listen, if you're doing this strictly for money, there are so many other industries to invest in. You wouldn't invest in this one.
It's a hard business.
Other than in a pizza joint, because God damn it, that food cost is insane. But anyway, so I think all of our investors are there for Marco and I, and they want to be part of this journey, and they are helping us achieve our goals.
And as you expressed, over 40 investors, different shapes and sizes, and different economic backgrounds. I like to think of that as a very populist type of investment strategy, much like the terroirs itself. Terroir is a non-exclusive environment. It's an environment that is often we hear that phrase a lot now, don't we? Teaching moments. There are teaching moments at terroir every time someone walks in the door, aren't there?
Well, listen, our tagline is the elitist wine bar for everyone. And when we opened up Tribeca and we splashed that on a big poster on the front window, one of the investors walked by and said, "You can't put that up there. That's going to offend people." And like, well,
maybe,
but that is exactly what we do. And if I'll tie that elitism into this singular vision that we have, and that sort of sounds inhospitable, and say that, okay, if you're going to take that attitude, I recognize that I got to bring people along for the ride. So mm-hmm. I am searching out moments of conversation.
Right.
That, yes, intimidation may be the first feeling that you have when you look at a terroir wine list, because you're not going to recognize the wines or the grapes or the producers or the regions or any of those things. So then the onus is on me to make you comfortable with it. And in
there's that great hospitality training.
Well,
this
is where
from,
we do right? express the hospitality.
Yeah.
Because hospitality, again, as Danny defines it, is a conversation. And that's all I do on a daily basis. I just want you to come into my joints. Say, I don't even want you to open the wine list. Sit down. Let's have a conversation. Tell me what you want to eat. Tell me what you want to drink. And then let me do my goddamn job. Marco's food is going to rock your world. The wine list, you know what? You might not like the first thing that I give you, but then I'm going to find something else. I might not have exactly what you want, but in the curation of that program, I have something that will mimic it stylistically. And that's ultimately, I think, what terroir brings to the conversation of the business of wine bars.
Yep.
That there are places with better lists. There are places with better food. There's places that are more comfortable. All of those things. But I would think that very few people educate the way we do. And that's the value add that makes terroir, terroir.
And I think about that, Paul, because you look at the business of terroir, and when you think of it as a business model, you can say, gosh, there's not a bar to entry in this business. Anyone could see this and think they could replicate it or create something more more easy to understand. But where I see the difference in terroir and how you and Marco approach it is that not everybody, as a matter of fact, no one but you and Marco can say, I'm going to show you a list that you don't know anything about. One of the nicest experiences I've ever had in a terroir was one of your servers asking me what kind of day I had and where I wanted to be in 15 minutes. And I thought to myself, that's an extraordinary insight into a guest who walks in after a tough day and just wants to be transported. But, you know, business being business, not everything works as it's originally planned out to work. You and Marco took an opportunity in Midtown a few years ago in 2007. To open a restaurant at a large hotel in Midtown called NCMA. You did not stay there for a long period of time, although it probably seemed like a very long period of time for you while you were in it. Can you tell us about that? I'm a believer, and I think most of the people who are listening to this are believers, that you learn more from the tough times, from the mistakes, than you do from the successes. What did you take away from that experience that makes you a better business person today?
Well, what I've learned is that there are no such things as no-brainers and gold mines, because I thought if there ever was a gold mine for us, how could this fail? We're on 7th Avenue and 51st, surrounded by high-rises with business people. We're near the theater district with thousands of people every night going to shows. We're in a hotel with hundreds of people staying every night. We have lunch. We have breakfast, lunch, and dinner crowds. We're there, easy to get to, center of the goddamn world. How can this fail? Well, goddamn it, did it fail. And it was a multitude of things that came about. In no particular order, the owners of the hotel, while, listen, extremely generous, they paid for the entire build of that place. If I could redo that relationship again, I would sit down and take the time and ensure that our culture was the same. And ultimately, their culture was different than our culture. But Marco and I were so entranced with the fact that people were going to build this dream restaurant of ours. So why even question it? Just go and do it. But at the end of the day, what split us apart was they viewed business differently than Marco and I did. Let's also acknowledge that it was a union site. And I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah.
The union was tough. Well, and I thought going in there with my, you know, hospitality background from Danny Meyer, that it would work for me. And boy, it did not work for me. It's not impossible, but it's hard. And when you come from an independent restaurant background, to go into that union shop, it requires a mindset that I simply didn't have. Right. And I would say, and this is in all honesty, from day one, not like day 100 that I'm backdating, day one, I immediately ran into the union and I thought to myself, holy shoot, what have I done? Yeah. And then, you know, we went right into mid-September 2008 with the crash of the market.
Right.
You know, Merrill Lynch was right down the street from us. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. And I will also say to those people who dined at NCMA that for Marco and I, it was probably our most perfect creation.
It was an extraordinary achievement. A Michelin star, a wonderful New York Times review.
No, forget that star, because that restaurant, more than anything we've done, expressed our background. It was overtly Italian. It was Marco cooking in a manner that was his aunt and his mom teaching him. It was me reverting back to where I grew up in Toronto at a formal Italian restaurant. It was a menu. NCMA means together, but it's not a union of individuals. It's a union of ideas. One side of the menu was, you know, old school Italian from Italy. And modern interpretations of those dishes, my God, the thought, the completeness of NCMA was extraordinary.
And
it's gone. And I don't think about it that often because I don't have many good memories, but I'll tell you.
But we have takeaways. We have takeaways. And from what I've heard from you today, the takeaways there, you know, were that not everything works, that our convictions are put on display in this business. Our soul is put on display to be celebrated or trampled upon. And it can be as simple as the change in the economy, or it can be as complicated as dealing with a deeply entrenched labor union that changes your costs so significantly that it can make it difficult to do.
Oh, listen, I hope everyone will chuckle when I make the next statement, but in January of 2009, our labor cost was 98%. 98%. Like, I don't even think, you know, Harvard Business School has not even theorized a P&L with 98%. It was so ludicrous.
Well, let's finish up by taking you to a happier place.
Please bring me to
a happier place. All right, let's bring you to a happier place. All right, you began your journey here in New York as a as the John the Baptist of wines and of wines that were not well known.
He's 2012. Dead, isn't he? Are you sure you want to reference a dead guy in relationship to me?
He did some pretty great things while he was alive.
He just baptized Jesus. What else did he do? I want to be the Jesus.
All right.
Because at least I get to come back.
So then give us three pieces of advice for someone who wants to be the grape juice Jesus, who wants to follow in your footsteps, who wants to say, I really want, I want a career in this world. What should they look out for? What should they try to do? Who should they associate with? Go.
Well, hospitality will be two, but number one will be, you don't have to be all things to all people.
Right.
Know what you know, be proud of what you know, put together a well-curated list that people can look at and see that there is a vision here. They may not understand what that vision is, and you may have to verbalize it, but that everything on that list matters. There's nothing extraneous. There's no things on there just because you had to put XYZ on there. No, that does not matter. Secondly, educate the people around you, because you can't get to every bloody table. My job on a daily basis is to take care of my staff, not the guest. My job is to take care of my staff.
Excellent.
Day in, day out, it's about education of my staff about the wines that we bought and that we're doing. And to be honest, thirdly, the ultimate measure of a great beverage director is not the wines that you've chosen. It is your back-of-the-house maintenance. Is your spreadsheet correct? Are the prices inputted correctly? Are you doing inventory? All of that so-called menial work, if it's not done, you are not a great beverage director just because you have cool shit on your list.
And you know what? You've just given me an opportunity, Paul, to say thanks for talking about the business of the business. It is exactly right. It's the detail. It's the discipline. Thanks for spending time with us today, Paul. It was inspiring for me, and I hope it was fun for everybody who listened. This is Phil Colicchio for the Business of the Business on heritageradionetwork.org. You can listen to us in the archive file or on iTunes as a podcast. See you next week. Paul, let's go get a glass of wine.
And a pizza.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.